As part of today's show on nonverbal communication, Greg has agreed to participate in the introduction without using language. Isn't that right, Greg? It's right. Okay, what are you trying to say to me now? Sounds like, okay, you're miming flying a kite, opening an umbrella, walking your dog. Sounds like kite umbrella dog? No? Sounds like mime? Yes, sounds like mime. Wow, that was tricky. All right, next word? Ice cream cone? Mick Jagger? No? Lick? Yes, that's it. Mime lick? Mime lick. I'm sorry, I'm not getting it. Okay, you're turning blue. Is blue the next word? No? All right, sounds like paddle. Sounds like canoe? Yes? Mime lick canoe? That means nothing to me. Okay, bulging eyes, pointing at throat. Stuck? Yes? Sounds like throat. Something about a mime-lit canoe that's stuck in a boat. Well, don't just give up. I was so close to getting it. Today we'll talk about a novel in which children are born with no language, about the art of mime, and about the real-life creation of language where none existed. Who else would do a radio show about not speaking? And now...
See, she's not going to say my name today. That was sort of part of the whole thing. All right. So, yeah, this is all occasioned by a book that I read. I read it in book form. I apparently missed the first wave of it. It's called The Silent History. So I got a reader's copy. It was like a few months ago that I got the reader's copy. And the premise of the book is that a cohort within sort of a modern generation of children, a subset of those children, are born with no capacity for language acquisition, none whatsoever. They can't read, they can't write, they can't speak, they don't hear language, they don't communicate with us. And then what spills out from there is, you know, a little bit of a kind of a dystopian, semi-futuristic fiction, and also some social satire and a whole bunch of other things as well. And what I knew just from reading the cover was that a lot of attention had been focused on the fact that the book had initially been absorbed by people as an app. It was something that you sort of looked at on your phone, and you got installments, and you could move around, and it was keyed to place and all kinds of things. I didn't do that anyway. I read the book, but I was fascinated by the premise of this book. What if you had no capacity for language acquisition? You couldn't learn sign language, for example. You couldn't do anything like that. You know, how different would your human outcomes be? So joining us now is one of the authors of the book. Eli Horowitz is the co-author of several books, and most recently, as I said, The Silent History with Matthew Derby and Kevin Moffitt. Previously, he was managing editor and publisher of McSweeney's for 8 years. So Eli and I could very easily have a conversation about this, but... it would be some. A lot of it would be speculative. Well, it turns out, thanks to the miracle of producer Betsy Kaplan, that there's somebody wasn't even located terribly far away from where I'm sitting right now. There's somebody who's really been thinking a lot about this very question: what kind of human outcomes are there when language acquisition hasn't happened? Marie Coppola is an assistant professor of psychology and linguistics at the University of Connecticut, where she directs the Language Creation Lab and is the founder and executive director of Manos Unidas. We'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go along. So, Eli Horowitz, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I've tried to lay out the premise of this. We're going to be talking much more about this notion of no language than we are about a book that started out as an app. But did I do okay with the premise of the book, of this cohort with no language acquisition?
Yeah, you did great. I was worried I was going to have to do it myself, but you did a great job. And then following them as they sort of form a community of their own, and so examining what happens in a community without language when they're not just outsiders.
Right. So they have their own community, and they have their own way of communicating that's not a sign language, right? Can you detail that? Can you give us a little bit more sense of what that means?
Sure. I mean, something we tried to really unravel and explore throughout the book was, how is communication different from language? We often hear them kind of as one is the same because our minds are so dominated by language. But there's all sorts of ways we communicate, by gestures, by facial expressions, that don't really fit language in any kind of linguistic sense. I mean, surely Marie can talk better about this than I can. But language is a pretty specific thing. It's hard to say exactly the boundaries of it, but it does mean something pretty specific and pretty specifically human, whereas communication is much wider ranging and maybe less cleanly understood.
Well, you know, one of the differences between the conversation you and I are having and the conversation that Marie and I are having is I can see her head nodding, her hand going up. There's all kinds of right. nonverbal things going on right now. So, Marie Coppola, and as we go along, we are going to flesh out quite a bit what your research is, what your experiences are, in both personal and professional, with this whole subject. But what about that? Is there communication without language?
I absolutely agree with Eli, and this is one of the distinctions that I stress when I teach about this to my students. Language is a very highly structured system that has the benefit of allowing communication, but communication can and does pretty much constantly happen, even when we're not using a spoken language or a signed language. I only just learned about your book, but I'm very, very interested to see how you flesh out those ideas, Eli.
In one of the things, you know, that we were realizing throughout the process was we all do this much more than we're aware of. Language is so much of a constant presence and a constant voice for us that we don't appreciate how much we're getting and on what a subtle level we're interpreting each other. You know, just the way an eyebrow is twisted, like the way that skepticism is different than skeptical amusement on the face. And we instantly understand it, but we couldn't describe it and we don't even understand that it's something that we do understand.
Marie, one constantly encounters various percentages for of how much of communication is nonverbal anyway. And you can see 55%, you can see 93%, you can see 112%. It depends which study you read, right? Nobody really knows that, do they?
No, I think that's too difficult to quantify given the huge range of environments and social settings in which we do communicate. It's definitely plays a large part in face-to-face communication. That's not the particular focus of my research, but I think we all know that. We sense when people are their emotional state. We understand things other than what they're saying with their mouth. It is pervasive, and we don't fully have conscious access to it.
Well, let's blow Eli Horowitz's mind a little bit and talk about what the focus of your research is, because this is pretty interesting. I mean, to whatever extent it's possible to find a group of people who are pretty close to the predicament, if that's the right word, that his characters have, you might have found it. So tell us about this.
Sure. So Eli, please feel free to jump in and correct me, because as I said, I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but the way Colin described it, it sounds like you are talking about no capacity for language, but you spoke in no capacity for reading and writing, which, of course, are parasitic on spoken language to begin with. But what we know from decades of research now is that sign languages use the same neural pathways and brain areas as spoken languages to a large degree. And so scientifically, it's a little hard to imagine not having any capacity for language at all, but yet still having something about the organism that wants to communicate, right? Somehow a social basis for wanting to exchange information between individuals and forming a community. So that's not something I think that you would ever see in real life. But what I have been studying in real life for the last 20 years is a situation in Nicaragua that is, as Colin said, a very close parallel to what you described, except that these are children who still have retained the capacity for language. It's just coming out as a sign language. They're going from using gestures and only seeing gestures as their only kind of communicative input and turning that into a language as they form a community.
Because these are, for the most part, deaf children, right, who have not been taught a sign language.
That's right. They were not taught a sign language, but the sign language emerged out of their interactions with each other at a school for special education in Nicaragua.
So, Eli, this is very close in some ways to your silence, at least in the sense that initially nobody from outside their world can teach them anything, but they can teach one another a system, which they all very quickly learn.
Yeah, that was actually a conscious – that Nicaraguan Sign Language scenario was definitely inspiration for a portion of the book. Just the hunger – like Marie says, sign language, you know, we very much understand as a kind of language, and so the children in our book don't have that. But what they do share with this Nicaraguan situation is the hunger to connect that can kind of transcend institutional barriers and sort of the spontaneity and flexibility, especially of children's minds, to do these things. So that was something we were very excited about. Yeah, the closest analog to our situation that we could see was individuals who, almost these children before they were brought to this school, deaf individuals in isolated situations where they don't have other they don't have a community to speak with, no one else knows sign language. That's the closest that we found to people in this condition. The other group that Marie can also talk better about, I bet, is cases where a child wasn't exposed to language but also has a whole host of other challenges, whether in some abusive situation or raised in the wild by wolves or whatever. You know, there's cases of that throughout history. But in those, it's often very hard to pinpoint what the effect of no language is and how to separate that from all the other difficulties they've got.
Well, Marie non-verbally indicated to me that she does want to talk about it, particularly that first thing, right? Yes.
I can't tell you how excited I am that we have gotten to the heart of this so quickly. Eli, you really have spent quite a great deal of time thinking about this and analyzing it, and I really can't wait to read your book. But it turns out that my major focus is not on that new language that's in Nicaragua, but on deaf people, exactly as you described, deaf people who live in Nicaragua, but because they live too far away from a deaf community and they don't have a strong enough infrastructure to have special education in most parts of the country, they are exactly living the situation that you just described. They're a single deaf person. Everybody around them speaks Spanish, which they cannot hear. And they haven't had the opportunity to interact with other deaf people, whether they sign or don't sign. And they're basically creating their own mini individual sign language. And for the last 20 years, I've been working with four deaf individuals like this and following them over time and trying to understand how much language they can come up with, how those gesture systems that we call home sign systems are similar to or different from established sign languages around the world, as well as how much communication is actually going on within those families. And what's the most striking finding that we've discovered recently is that the family members don't understand them very well, which just blows people away. And so, yeah, I'll just stop there.
Well, let's don't understand them as people or don't understand the signs?
They don't understand the content of the gestures. So their communication mm-hmm. is really limited to exactly the kinds of things that I think maybe you're focusing on in your book. They're other sort of more whole body or emotional type signals like facial expressions or just routines or certain contexts. They really don't even so the language that the deaf person has invented, the home signer has invented, even that sort of mini language is not understandable to the family members. And they rely on these other cues and contexts to communicate whatever they can.
And Eli, you know, one of the things that happens in your book that's a little bit different from what Marie's describing right now is that this particular cohort of silence ultimately decides that their own company would be vastly preferable for the most part to their parents or other people who simply aren't like them. So it's very much about that experience of other. But I think one of the things that you're both interested in that's very interesting within the context of your novel and I think of great interest to Marie is, then what are the human outcomes? I mean, within the fictionalized world of your novel, one of the things that happens is that not only do the silent people, not only do they decide to live together, in many cases, live communally, but they don't really necessarily live any kind of parallel life to what everybody else is leading. I mean, they live sometimes in squalor. They live, you know, they don't adopt a lot of mores that go along with being part of the speaking, hearing, language using community. Talk about that decision. What was your thinking about that?
Well, in the later portions of the book, when those communities start to spring up, we were then exploring it less as a linguistic phenomenon, as a psychological phenomenon, but sort of how groups define themselves, how we understand the other. You know, this, in a way, the language barrier became a useful way to just explore the other, mm-hmm. which is obviously sort of a classic fictional trope, is how people react to what they couldn't understand. And this, the silence as a kind of very firm, clean division between the two groups. And, you know, we see all the time in all different levels of society, groups that are ostracized sort of eventually reclaim their own identity. and take that as a point of pride. And sometimes they're trying to assimilate, but sometimes they want to self-segregate. They want to have pride in who they are themselves. You know, we see things in the deaf community currently with cochlear implants about whether they are having a disability that should be fixed or their own society that should be preserved. And so we try to imagine that and play it out to its logical conclusion.
And Marie, that's got to be of some interest to you, that whole question, too. Obviously, you're dealing right now with a lot of people who are in very individual circumstances and who probably really do would vastly prefer to be able to join the immediate society of their nuclear family, maybe the larger society of their village. But, you know, when you look at larger populations of people who are non-hearing people, as Eli says, sometimes there are some identifications that they make that they would be reluctant to give up.
Yes. Well, I mean, for most signing deaf adults, the deaf community is the only place where they have the same kind of unfettered ability to share their thoughts and feelings with others. They mostly have grown up in families where there's communication has been limited to one degree or another. And of course, you would prefer to be in a community where you can be yourself and be understood and understand what others are telling you all the time and not constantly feel excluded and isolated.
I just want to go back to the people that you're talking about, the people who are they're rural people in Nicaragua. They haven't had this urban experience of this learned language that wasn't really created by any outside force or anything like that, but simply people who become their own version of signing people in these urban Nicaraguan environments. But the people you're looking at, they live in rural environments. Nobody teaches them international sign language. They don't learn this thing. And in terms of human outcomes there, you know, I mean, they're also not Peter the Wild. You know, they're not
right.
They're not growing up and they're not being raised by wolves or, you know. So how estranged from the value sets around them do they become?
That's a really great question, Colin. So it is important, I think, to recognize that there aren't the same kinds of limitations as there are with feral children and cases of abuse, many of them well known, like the case of Jeannie. In the United States, if we do see differences between how home signers, these deaf individuals who are creating their own language, if we see differences in how they understand the world or understand other people, then we can be a little bit more confident that it has to do with this lack of linguistic input and the limitations of their language system. And that's actually what a couple of current lines of research in my laboratory are addressing. We're looking at how these deaf people understand quantity, whether they can learn to count, for example, and also their social cognition. How do they understand other people? They're not socially impaired. At an organic level, there's nothing intrinsic to them that is causing them to not be able to understand others socially because they have fairly relatively normal social interactions. They have friends. They interact with their family members. They talk to other people in their communities. Some of them have children. They have jobs. So it is very interesting we have observed some very interesting limitations in their abilities that do make them a little bit different from people who have a full language. And I could talk more about that at some point.
Well, yeah, I think we do want to talk more about that. And we're going to take a break in just a second here. First of all, I'm going to mention who we're talking to. You just heard Marie Coppola. She's an assistant professor of psychology and linguistics at the University of Connecticut, where she directs the Language Creation Lab and the founder and executive director of Manos Unidas. Eli Horowitz is the co-author of several books, but most pertinently, The Silent History. I believe there's a launch party tonight for the book version of The Silent History, featuring Eli and his co-author, Matthew Derby, with special guests, including Sloane Crosley, one of our favorite guests on this show ever. You should mention to her, Eli, that she owes us a guest appearance.
A proud Connecticut, right?
Yes. And MSNBC's Alex Wagner and Ezra Balint. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yep.
And so anyway, that's all going to be happening tonight at the Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn. And I don't know how many of our listeners can rush over to that, but maybe some will. So before we go to break, you know, Eli, because I want to talk a lot more about this. I should also say in the final segment we are going to add, because we have to have a conversation with a mime. So Bill Bowers, who's a world-renowned mime and actor who studied with the legendary Marcel Marceau, will join us in the third segment here. But, you know, even thinking about Bill Bowers, Eli, and thinking about what Marie just said and reading your book, to me, I really started thinking about that whole issue of to what degree does our psychological constitution, our set of social reactions, our ability to function in society, how much of it is completely dependent on linguistic input at some point? So that, you know, even if I'm watching Bill Bowers do mime, well, maybe that's not a good example, but let's say I'm watching slapstick, okay? Let's say I'm watching Peter Sellers or Charlie Chaplin or something like that. So there's no words involved there, and I'm laughing because I'm seeing... If I'm laughing, I'm laughing because I'm seeing some kind of physical pain or some kind of, you know, awkward physical situation that's couched for me in a safer setting so that I understand it's not really a dangerous thing. The person isn't experiencing real pain, so I can now laugh at this. You know, I started to wonder if I had no language acquisition capacity, how dependent on that substructure am I for understanding something as completely wordless as slapstick, which I think is part of the question that you're asking about the people in your book.
Certainly. That's right at the core of the book. And obviously, language is ubiquitous in our understanding of those things. The question is it necessarily ubiquitous? Or is it more just the chattering voice, the little annoying voiceover we do to kind of create a filter between us and our experience? Marie was talking about the limitations that may be created by the lack of language, and certainly those exist. But what I also was wondering is, in what ways does the language limit us? Does the language come between us and the more true experience? In which ways is language kind of an impoverished way to have certain kinds of experiences or interactions? You know, if someone asks you, how are you feeling? How was your day? I think we all know that pretty good or I'm grouchy, those are actually pretty weak depictions of our internal states. And those can be conveyed much more clearly through other forms of communication and other forms of expression. And so the extent to which we're dependent on language is not always useful to us. And the extent to which we're unable to imagine an experience outside it, I think, is a weakness on our parts. And right. So that's what the book was trying to do, is imagine another kind of experience.
Okay, there's so much about that I just want to explore. We're supposed to go to break. But before we go to break, so I don't lose that, Marie.
I'm definitely coming back to that, so you don't have to worry.
All right, let's go to break there. There's about eight trains of thought that I have right now, and I think I can only hold on to about two of them, but that's all right. The guests will figure it all out. We'll take a break, and we'll come back.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like.
All right, we're back. We're talking about people who must or can try to communicate without using language. And so Eli Horowitz is with us, the co-author most recently of The Silent History with Matthew Derby and Kevin Moffitt. This is a novel. It's a fascinating novel, and it really does sort of work as kind of a semi-dystopian future fiction and some satire as well and a lot of other things. But it is about a subset of a generation born where children are born with no ability to acquire language. Marie Coppola is assistant professor of psychology and linguistics at the University of Connecticut, where she directs the Language Creation Lab. She's also the founder and executive director of Manos Unidas. So as we were going into the break, Marie, Eli was talking about that whole question of, okay, so we understand what an incredible deficit and impairment it would be not to have language, but he had started to wonder also whether there were any kinds of impoverishments or deficits created by language, by having language. So you've got two groups of people that you can look at here. One of them would be the group of deaf people living in urban situations in Nicaragua, where without any intervention, they invented their own sign language, which I think we all know that if you and I and Lee, Eli and Betsy and Kion were plopped down in urban Nicaragua, we wouldn't be able to do that. It would take us we probably wouldn't be able to invent a full sign language that we could use to communicate. You're also looking at these people in rural Nicaragua who don't have access to other deaf people with whom to build this language and don't have access to any other kinds of interventions to help them learn language. And one of the things you're saying to us is their families can't understand the self-created idiosyncratic communication styles and structures that they try to develop, which kind of reinforces Eli's point a little bit, right?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, there is some degree of communication there, but it does seem to be limited to these non-linguistic aspects. And this is a line of research that I've just begun with one of my graduate students, Emily Carrigan. If you decontextualize the gestures, if they're describing events where it could be anything, right? It could be a man drinking a cup of water or a woman drinking a cup of water, and you have the home signer express that with their gestures, and then you show that to their mothers are not not very accurate in – they're not terrible. They're better than chance at picking the right picture that goes with that sentence, but – the very, very striking part is that if you show that same sentence to a signer of American Sign Language who has never seen that home signer before, doesn't know anything about Nicaraguan Sign Language or Nicaraguan culture, and more importantly, has not lived with that person for the last 25 or 30 years, they are better able to extract the meaning of those sentences than their own mothers and family members. And that is really, really striking to us. And that, to us, indicates how these home sign systems have gone from being gestures that are really tied to the context in the here and now and to certain routines is really becoming transformed into a linguistic system that has systematic relational properties where the gestures relate to each other in predictable ways that those family members, they haven't learned the grammar of that home sign system.
Of course, you know, one of the we can fall. I mean, I'm sure you don't, but we in conversation can fall into the trap, Eli, of thinking. I mean, you gave a great example of it. You ask somebody, "How are they doing?" or "How was their day?" and you can say, "I'm fine. It was fine," or whatever. And that could mean all kinds of different things, right? Including "It was terrible," or "I don't feel like talking about it," or "I actually did have a good day." Or, I mean, we don't always use language to convey an exact set of meanings. We use language in lots of very slippery and complicated ways. Language is eminently messy.
Yeah, definitely. And we are not fully aware of it. We think, you know, we can pick it up in sort of in politics or in advertising, things where we're conscious that someone is trying to sell it to ourselves or sell things to us. But what we're less conscious of is how we're selling things to ourselves all the time. You know, just walking into the studio today, just my constant narration of every person I see in the street and trying to find the thing and am I late, it's tiring. It's tiring and it's not necessarily accurate. So, you know, I think it's true for some of these experiments that Maria is talking about. I mean, that was a fascinating experiment. But still, it's about conveying facts, conveying information. I think it's definite that language is probably the best tool for that. But when it's these other things that you're talking about, conveying emotional states, I mean, I bet these mothers love their children. You know, how do they communicate that love? Is that communicated through words or gestures, or is it communicated through other forms of communication? There's a lot of forms of experience that we have trouble being conscious of. We have trouble pinning down. We have trouble testing precisely because they're non-linguistic kinds of experience.
You want to react to that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Eli. And as you said that, I was reminded of the situation of my own father. So I don't come to this by accident. Both of my parents are deaf and use American Sign Language. And it was one of my first languages along with English. And my grandmother, my father is like 95% of deaf people in the United States. He was born into a family where everybody was hearing except for him. And he was born at a time where the recommendations to parents were, do not learn sign language because then your child will never learn to speak and it won't be good for your child. Well, I mean, we could have a whole other show about all of that, all of those issues. But the bottom line here is that she really communicated with him through food. Her parents had immigrated from Italy. She was a wonderful cook. She had a restaurant in upstate New York, and she really communicated with him through food. And the rest of his family sort of picked other ways to interact with him and communicate with him and communicate their affection and love for him. One relative would always take him to the movies. Another relative, you know, would do other things with him. But the fact that we all have language and these other ways to do to express emotions and those kinds of things, that's really great. But when you only have that, that is very, very limiting for us as humans. And that's it limits the kinds of things that can go on in your own mind as an individual, and it limits your ability to form really close relationships with other people. I don't want to say that deaf people, either in my family or in my research, don't have any. They are not able to optimally express their affection and love for each other because they only have those nonverbal, non-linguistic channels to rely on.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if the deaf people in your study have had interactions with each other.
They have occasionally met each other, but they haven't had extended interactions with each other. But to more to your question, there is one deaf person I have worked with who actually does live in Managua, where there is a vibrant deaf community. And in fact, I met him at the deaf community there in the deaf club. And he understood that they were like him, that they talked with their hands, and he understood that they could all understand each other, and he could understand a little bit. And I thought after that first meeting, I would never be able to continue studying his home sign system because, of course, he would go learn this new language. Like, how amazing that he could now be part of this community. He has not become part of that community. That happened 18 years ago, and he's happy with what he has. I mean, he knows where they are. He could go there anytime, but he has chosen not to, which is very different from the experiences of deaf people in the United States. Once they find the deaf community after they've been isolated linguistically for a long time because their families have kind of encouraged them to speak and understand English and really haven't embraced sign language as a means of communication, that doesn't happen here. When people get into the deaf community, it's just this huge sigh of relief, and that's now their world. But for this guy, it wasn't, and it speaks a little bit to cultural differences in these nonverbal behaviors and the use of gesture by hearing people in Nicaragua. They go to town. I mean, you just see these gesture conversations happening all over the place, all the time. Have a much richer repertoire of gestures that they use, and they're much better able to communicate with a deaf person who doesn't share a language with them than anybody in the United States is. It's been very, very remarkable to us as researchers.
That really is fascinating. You know, I want to just shift gears a tiny, tiny bit, although not much. Eli Horowitz, this is one of the few shows you're going to do in which the interviewer is not constantly dwelling on the evolution of this novel through an app. But there is one little part of this that I do find interesting, and that is whether or not the book itself and the notion of the silence, you know, this generation or this portion of a generation that can't acquire or use language, arose or may have arisen from any kind of anxiety about the transformation that we're all engaging in digitally right now. And, you know, I just spent 4 days teaching a writing workshop down in New Haven. I'm in Hartford most of the time. And one of the differences between Hartford and New Haven is the streets are just much more full in New Haven of people in their late teens and early 20s who are using their phones all the time. And I just realized I had to develop a slightly different physical reaction system and social reaction system, because a lot of people just are walking towards you about to smash into you, you know, and they just don't know it. And I'm not used to that. And you know, I mean, there, you know, McLuhan talks about how, you know, we were going to use technology to extend our dendrites out into the universe. And we did that. But I'm keenly aware that it's just not a complete boon, right? There are ways in which we are cut off from old styles of communication simply because we're hyper-reliant on new devices.
Yeah, I think that's true. And not even anything very specific about cell phones or e-books or anything like that, but just we are becoming – there's just maybe more and more chatter. And there's more and more chatter that we mistake for experience, or that becomes a replacement for experience, or how the experience gets mediated, whether that's in our consumption of media or our communication with each other. You know, and I'm fully a part of this as much as anyone. And I think in some ways it's also just a skepticism about writing. You know, we were three writers who wrote this book about how language can hold us back and something to be on some level suspicious of. You know, the more that we do these things, you also can see how it's kind of a a pretty thin layer of experience, the way we express ourselves. So it's tied up with all those things. And, you know, we kind of only discovered the book throughout the writing of the book. It wasn't a screed or didn't have a thesis statement to start with.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to add to this conversation in, I think, some interesting ways, too, that really do correspond very neatly to Marie's work and to Eli's book. Bill Bowers will join us, a world-renowned mime, right after this.
Can you do it every day? How do you communicate? Do they listen when you talk? Do they watch you when you walk? Do you have a winning style? Do you know just when to smile? Communication is a strong foundation to society.
Just say it. Just say what you're doing. Come on, just go ahead and tell us. Just say what it is. What? Again? Dang, this is the fifth time I've been kicked out of a mime show. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Brittany Hill and Katie Pikus. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and sort of appeared in the intro. The part of Bill Curry was played by Teller. For show pages, articles, and video to the Faith Middleton Show staff's new project, Schmoozeless Food, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, our salute to game shows. And now, back to Colin.
All right. We've been having, to my way of thinking anyway, a fascinating conversation about this whole notion of communication without language, and particularly by communication by and for people who have not acquired language one way or another. Eli Horowitz is the co-author with Matthew Derby and Kevin Moffitt of The Silent History. This is a novel about a group of people, part of a generation of children born without language acquisition, cannot speak, cannot understand language, cannot read, cannot write. Marie Coppola is an assistant professor of psychology and linguistics at the University of Connecticut, where she studies a similar phenomenon in many ways. Groups of people, primarily in Nicaragua, who are deaf but have not been taught by intervention sign language, and either develop their own home signing systems or learn this separate urban language that which has been evolved by the deaf people in urban settings all by themselves. So we're going to add to this conversation somebody who volitionally and electively chooses to communicate without words. That's Bill Bowers. He's a world-renowned mime and actor, studied under Marcel Marceau. He's performed at the Kennedy Center, the White House, and on Broadway in The Lion King, The Scarlet Pimpernel. He's currently appearing in The Mystery of Irma Vep at Berkshire Theater Group, Fitzpatrick Main Stage in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. That'll be running through July 19th. Welcome to this conversation, Bill Bowers.
Thank you very much. And I have to tell you, this is not my first radio interview as a mime.
Well, you're not the first mime we've had on our radio show either. So,
there you go.
We really are that perversely inclined that we would have talked on more than one occasion to more than one mime. But, you know, listening to this conversation, you know, one of the things that I was going to ask you is when part obviously mime is kind of like haiku, right? You're imposing on yourself a set of restrictions. So that's a choice. And I'm wondering also, when people watch mime, when they're sitting in the audience watching you, do you sense in them any kind of anxiety? Like, what if I can't understand it? What if I don't get it? Is that part of the tension that creates the excitement of the performance?
Absolutely. I feel that's always part of my job as a performer that works without language, for the most part, is to address and deal with the resistance in the room. And I usually, you know, choose pieces that kind of ease an audience into how they have to participate in making the performance happen, because it really is a contract between me as a performer and the audience that they're going to participate in an imaginary world. So, there's always resistance. And I think some of it is that they're not going to understand it. Some of it is the connotation of mime, particularly in this country, is such a negative kind of, you know, butt of a joke kind of thing that people think, well, it doesn't have meaning, or it's going to be weird, or it's going to be, they're going to, you know, hit me with an imaginary rope or something, you know. So there certainly are guards up by an audience.
You know, as we were during the break, Marie was saying, you know, she was talking about what the limitations would be for you. Like she was saying he probably can't communicate what happened yesterday. I don't know. What were some of the other ones that you were saying, Marie?
What will happen tomorrow or what someone else thinks or all kinds of things that we really seem to need language to do.
Do you agree with that? I mean, how many limitations do you feel, or is it just a matter of getting your act together and you could say almost anything?
Well, that's an interesting question. I travel a lot in Europe and other countries, and when, of course, you know, English is just spoken in so many places now, but I have found that I've never had a problem communicating what I need to communicate if I don't have the language to do it. It really is my first language, so I'm very comfortable with trying to figure out how to say things non-verbally. And I find that it's just a place that other people can find their way to communicate, you know, essential things that you need to say to someone right now. So I don't feel like it has many limits.
Eli Horowitz, you seem to have thought about everything in terms of thinking about this imagined group of people who can't talk and can't understand language. I would assume mimes were in there somewhere, but this would be your opportunity either to ask a question or direct a comment to somebody who's actually working as a mime.
Well, I think what's most interesting about Bill and people in his position, whether mimes or even to some extent actors and actresses, is having to become conscious of these things that we are doing unconsciously all the time to maximize this form of communication. So I don't know if there's a question in here, but there must be all these moments when you're realizing, if I bend my face like this, if I bend my body like that, it will create this kind of understanding and this kind of emotional state in the viewer, and having to kind of become very precise about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like most of my job as a mime and as an actor is to be an observer and to collect sensations and gesture and things I view in the world, and then find a way to not simplify them, but heighten them in a sense. So it's when I work with students, I always talk about mime being a heightened truth. You're trying to be as truthful as you can be in a heightened physical language so that the largest amount of people can hook into you and follow you.
You know, Marie, that sort of leads me to the answer to this question is 4 hours long, unfortunately. But, you know, he's saying something really interesting, which is, and Eli's saying something really interesting, which is, as a mime, Bill Bowers, he's thinking about that. He's thinking, if I bend my face this way and my body that way in a very precise way, if I heighten it, you know, I can communicate these very precise things. So, but there's some kind of gap between that and what one of these home signing deaf people in Nicaragua who have tried to develop their own, try to really be Bill Bowers in a certain way. If I bend my face this way, if I move my hands that way, if I do this, my family will understand what I'm thinking. Where's the gulf there between what Bill can do and what's almost impossible to do for the people that you study?
That's a great point. And again, this goes back to this distinction between language and communication that we talked about earlier in the show. And communication can take many forms, right? It can take the form of mime. It can take the form of your dog observing your behavior and predicting what kinds of things you're going to do. That's obviously communication, but that's not linguistic. And what's different about language is that it's a productive system that uses these little chunks of meaning that aren't themselves meaningful, that we then put together in these very systematic ways. And of course, I realize that as I'm saying this, Bill is probably thinking, well, that's exactly what I do too, right?
Well,
I wish we had longer to really get into this. Because obviously, when you study something so closely and that you're talking about these observations, these very, very close nuanced observations that you make that you then bring into focus, right? That is really incredible. And of course, only a very few people are talented with that. Most people can't travel around the world and have conversations, successful conversations with just about everybody they meet. I mean, I'm kind of one of those people and you're one of those people, but we come to that through a very specialized set of experiences that has kind of led us down that path. People can get by with gesture without speaking, but usually that requires a pretty interactive, for a normal person, right? that requires, and I mean typical by normal, for the typical person who hasn't honed this expertise in some way, that is requires some sort of cooperation and back and forth interaction with somebody who's really willing to enter into that. Uh-huh. And
You know, that goes to another point about that willingness to enter into that too. Bill, yeah. You know, in Eli's book, the people who can't acquire language, that kind of person is called a silent, and it's a semi pejorative term, I think, for some people. And in this book, and you know, sometimes even watching people who communicate only by sign language, I think in some of us there's a little anxiety that wells up just because they're not making any noise, but they're communicating, and I'm not used to that. And yeah. I'm guessing with audiences that one of the things you have to struggle with is people, particularly when you perform in Washington, God help you, people have a problem with silence, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very, it's a very vulnerable place to ask people to sit in. And I've spent a lot of time in my life thinking about this because, you know, if you think about places of silence, they're temples and churches and libraries, they're places of contemplation and thought. And so when you ask an audience to really be in that silent space, it's vulnerable. They might actually feel something. And that's the, by and large, the main comment I've gotten anywhere I've performed for my entire career is people will say to me, oh, I had no idea I would be feeling so much on a mime show, or I didn't realize I was going to cry. You know, I think sometimes language and, you know, bells and whistles and sounds, that keeps feelings at bay in a way. It's something you can put in front of actually emoting.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And I think it is really something a limited group of people are conscious of their ability to do this. But I actually think we all have a really strong ability to interact this way to some extent. I mean, you can do it as simply as just turning the sound off in a movie. You'll understand 90% and then just take a moment to think, why do I know what that person is basically saying? Why do I know what they're feeling? And, you know, it's not that that this can do everything the language can. Marie said some very good examples of things the language is uniquely good for, talking about things that aren't there, talking about the past, talking about the future. The question is, do we structure our experience to make that kind of information more important than it really needs to be at the expense of other kinds of experience, other kinds of information?
Right. I think some of it for me is being present with another human being. Mm-hmm. And within that comes a willingness and maybe a way to hone the ability to communicate without words, is to actually be available to each other. And that's what I find, as a teacher, that's what I try to encourage students to do, is to just take away sound and allow that presence between each other. And that opens, it seems to open up portals in us that we may not ordinarily want to open up.
We're going to have to stop there, although we could I have to introduce our fourth guest, Umberto Eco, who's now going to explain what language actually is. No, that's actually not happening. We're all done. But although I just would quickly say here, you know, one of the things we didn't have time to get into, there's like 15 things we didn't have time to get into. But, you know, just even building on what Bill just said, I think there's also this strong prejudice, and you see it in some of the characters in Eli's novel, and I'm sure Marie encounters it too, that when language isn't being used, that means something intellectually inferior is happening.
Spoken language.
Yeah, spoken language is a sign of intelligence, and lack of spoken language is implicitly cruder and less intelligent. And I think that extends even to mime. I think there's people going, well, I mean, if he's not going to talk, he can't possibly tell me anything interesting or important. So, I mean, that's like a whole other area of prejudice. But if you want to experience some of that, or at least see that in an interesting way, do read The Silent History. Even if you missed the app phenomenon, you didn't do it that way, I've enjoyed the book a lot, and certainly you'll never think about wallabies quite the same way again. Eli Horowitz, Matthew Derby, and Kevin Moffitt wrote that book. Marie Coppola has been with us from the Manos Unidas and the Language Creation Lab, and of course Bill Bowers. Go see him in The Mystery of Irma Vep at Berkshire Theater Group in Stockbridge. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan and Kyone Wolf for pulling this show together.
I'm Kyone Wolf. 10 years ago today, my best friend ran off to become a mime. She kept quiet about it for, I guess, her whole life, and then I never heard from her again.